This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Let's not waste any more of their time. I am so honored to welcome back to the program acclaimed journalists Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald. Their new book is Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story. Good afternoon to you both.
Coy, I think we're having a technical problem. There we go.
There we go. How are y'all doing?
We're doing fine, thank you. How are you?
Very, very good. Happy Monday.
Oh, thank you.
So I want to just start with a very basic question, and you both or just one can answer. I'll leave that up to you. We see Pakistan and Afghanistan so much in the news, and let's focus this part of our conversation, if we can, on Pakistan. What is it that you think Americans need to know and understand about Pakistan that isn't in the news enough, or perhaps not even at, not even at all?
I think what really isn't made clear is the fact that there has been a historical bias towards Pakistan's position in the region. And that bias has really been going on now since the creation of the state of Pakistan. And what you're looking at today is literally an attitude that says, I'll give you an example, okay? You have the circumstances between India and Pakistan that people are aware now. There have been embassies blown up in Kabul because they actually hosted Indian ambassadors. You have the Mumbai explosions. You have all these examples of the attitude of Pakistan towards India. But the attitude of Congress towards Pakistan is really very tolerant of those kinds of ways of dealing with their differences with India. Now, India has not blown up Pakistani embassies to show their disregard. They have been at war. There are definitely serious issues here. But there are differences the way that we deal with India's reaction to Pakistan versus Pakistan's reaction to India.
Paul, how about you?
Well, we have a history that goes back. This is one of the reasons why we wrote the book, was to give people an idea of the long-term history of the Western attitude towards Afghanistan. And you know, you got to go back. We probably talked about this in the last time on your show, that you've got to go back to the 1830s to look at the Western reaction to Afghanistan. That was the first time. 1839 was the first Anglo-Afghan War. There were debates in the British Parliament for year after year after year about how to treat the Afghans. And initially, it was viewed by some people who were members of the East India Company that Afghanistan was really kind of the jewel in the crown. You know, that you could really go in there, establish a very strong Afghanistan, and it would protect the British Empire in India. And there were other people who believed that was the wrong thing to do back in the 1830s and 40s and 50s. And they debated over whether Afghanistan should be broken up into its various ethnic constituencies. And that would be a better protection against against Russia, the emergence of Russia coming down into that area. And so this is what's been going on ever since. And it has been a real effort on behalf of they call it the Anglo-Saxon thinkers, the Anglo-Saxon and intellectual, military, and industrial complex, to try to turn Afghanistan into kind of a parking lot, a vacant place where pipelines or trade routes or whatever could just simply go through there without having to worry about the attitudes of the Afghan people. And the United States, unfortunately, picked that attitude up in 1947. So as a result of that, our thinking on Afghanistan is really early 19th century Western imperialistic thinking that's long since proven itself to be outmoded, outdated. These people are very sophisticated in that part of the world. You've got, you know, Afghanistan is surrounded by Russia, by Iran, by India, and by China. These are all influences on the Afghan political scene. And so as a result of that, I don't think the American people who deal with this and in the American policy establishment are really up to speed on what needs to be done to resolve this in any kind of equitable way.
We're talking with journalists Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald. Their new book is Invisible History. I strongly recommend it. It's Afghanistan's untold story. If you truly want to have some grasp and some historic context of what's going on there and the mess in which we have found ourselves, I strongly recommend you read this. Elizabeth, if I hear y'all right, it sounds like that America is simply pursuing a failed 19th century British policy that didn't work over 100 years ago, and we can't expect it to work now.
That is exactly a good, that's an excellent way to describe it. And we, in fact, we think that we wonder all the time about why the failure of a 19th century policy would be attractive. And that is one of the things specifically about, again, this Pakistani dilemma. When you really do look at, you know, the British decision to effectively break up Afghanistan as a solution to their inability to colonize it, and the creation of the state of Pakistan really is out of something like 5/8 of it was Afghan Pashtun homelands, and the big crisis that you hear about, the rise of the Taliban, all of these issues are directly related to this region where you have all these Pashtuns who happen to now be on the Pakistani side but have never recognized the Durand Line, which was the line used by the British to denote this demarcation, which eventually became effectively the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan. So that's why, again, when you come into the modern age and you hear about the rise of the Taliban, and you then discover historically the Taliban really was a creation of Pakistan to create a Pakistani-friendly government in Afghanistan. Why? Because they wanted what they referred to as strategic depth with their eventual war with India. So what we can see in the region is actually a crisis really between India and Pakistan that the United States really needs to resolve. The United States certainly in a diplomatic way, and also we really need to look at the region in terms of Iran, Russia, China, and its relationship and its ability to also play a role in helping to resolve this problem. In fact, the Russians are particularly anxious about the drug trade. They have a tremendous problem with drug addicts at this point and the flow of drugs coming out of the region, again, because of the destabilization of Afghan civil society, you know, certainly since the re-rise of the Taliban, going on now for another 5 years.
We're talking with Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald. The new book is Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story. So, Paul, let me ask you this, and Elizabeth as well. What does Obama need to do? What do Americans need to do? We heard that he, you know, sent his advisors back to the drawing board while he was going to be overseas and said, when I get back, I want some answers. What do you think that we need to do? Because it just doesn't seem to be getting any better, and yet every day we hear, you know, some soldier is losing an arm or a leg or even their life.
It's a very complicated situation, and it's been made more complicated, of course, by 8 years of essentially incompetent leadership on behalf of the United States when it came to this issue. It was basically disregarded in favor of Iraq. What he can do right now is, I think he is trying to do. The problem with his efforts are that there's still a number of different agendas going on at the White House. And that, I think, is keeping the White House from making a consolidated, straightforward approach. Pakistan, needless to say, has a right to its own foreign policy. It has a right to its own borders. It has a right to its own integrity. But unfortunately, Pakistan defines itself as you know, needing to upset the balance in India, in Kashmir, and in Afghanistan in order to defend its own integrity. And of course, that's wrong. But these are a lot of legacy issues. So, I mean, he really needs, I mean, I've heard it suggested that at one point that what he should really do as the President of the United States is that he should preside over a lawyer jirga and invite all of these parties from both Afghanistan and Pakistan, these tribal areas of Pakistan, which were, by the way, traditionally part of Afghanistan. He should invite them all together and almost assume the role of the big chief here. I know whether this would work or not, who knows, but at this point, the military solution, of course, as we know, isn't going to work. There has to be some kind of political solution, but you have an enormous amount of individual ethnic issues going on the Pakistani side of the border specifically. You've got issues with Baluchistan and their own independence. They've been suppressed by the Pakistani military since the 1947 creation of Pakistan. You have all these Pashtun tribes who have been suppressed by the Pakistani government. They have not been included in the Pakistani political process. We don't tend to hear about the fact that these people are living in feudal conditions that were imposed upon them by the British Empire in the 19th century, and those conditions have not changed at all. And what we've done is we've gone in, unfortunately, I think this is a very unenlightened approach, we've gone in and supported Pakistan's essentially Punjabi military to help suppress a lot of these various groups in these independence groups in Sindh, in Baluchistan, in Pashtunistan, what is known as Pashtunistan, Northwest Frontier Provinces, the federally administered tribal areas. And we have assisted in oppressing these people alongside the Pakistani military. And, of course, what has this done? This has basically been an open invitation for the Taliban to come in to these various ethnicities, ethnic groups, and say, oh, well, you see, the Pakistani military, the Punjabis, and the U.S. military are in league with each other, so you should come in league with us against them. And so it's a natural recruiting tool. And, of course, you know, they claim, of course, that you'd need somewhere between, to fight that kind of insurgency, you'd need somewhere around 800,000 troops, and that's not even possible. So what we need is we need a completely new way of dealing with this thing. We have to redress, the president really has to redress some of the underlying ethnic issues that go back to the division of this area in the 19th century by the British Empire and start to unravel some of that problem that was created.
And the other side of it is also in terms of the region. We really have to begin to recognize that when the British Empire went in there in the 19th century, its goal was to stop the Russian Empire from having any effect. Well, once again, we are living with failed British policy. Once again, there is still a level of agenda out there that wants to keep Russia out of its own backyard and having any positive effect. So these ideas really, we've got to mature out of this sort of Cold War framework. And we have someone like, you know, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who has really been a key motivator of maintaining this Cold War framework. Well, it was Zbigniew Brzezinski who originally, you know, activated the idea of drawing the Soviets into the Afghan trap so that, that they could be destroyed there in the first place, which actually led to this immense financing of this whole holy war that now has turned into a terrorist war against every person in the region.
Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald are my guests. Their new book is Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story. Here's what gets me, and I want you both to respond to this. When we look at the evidence that came out of 9/11, those hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. We see checks coming out of Pakistan, the ISI, the Pakistani CIA, the ISI actually sending money to fund Mohammed Atta. Now, whether that was coming from Pakistan or they were rerouting it from Saudi Arabia, I don't know. But clearly, Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, very involved in 9/11. And yet, you know, this many years later, those are our two allies against the war on terror?
Well, as you say, you can see why this isn't being resolved very quickly. And that's been an issue from the very beginning. I mean, we're living up and around the Boston area. And, of course, right after 9/11, of course, the entire United States was shut down to air traffic. And what pulls into Logan Airport but a plane to pick up the local constituency of the Bin Laden family who were all, you know, living in the Boston area. And so they get on the plane, the lieutenant governor or the governor of Massachusetts allowed the plane to come in. They get picked up, put on the plane, and sent out of town, you know, before anybody can even ask them a question. So, you know, when you talk about, you know, agendas, separate agendas that are going on, the oil agenda has been an agenda that's been, you know, been dominating Western nations for, once again, over 100 years. You know, as there was ever since the British Navy transferred from coal steamers to oil-fired boilers in their battleships back in the 1880s and 1890s. This has been a major issue. Now, the fact is that, you know, there's a lot of people in Texas who are in the oil business. Jim Baker is an example, who's been a major wheel in a lot of Republican administrations. He of course, his law firm is Baker Botts in Houston, and that's an oil law firm. He's been involved with a lot of deals. You have the Taliban, of course, were invited into Houston back in the 1990s, late 1990s, to wine and dine them. Well, not exactly wine, I guess, but perhaps fruit juice and
yeah.
dine them because of their Muslim background. And you know, so this is something that's been going on. This is another agenda that is part of American politics. And as I say, what this does is this stops the United States government. When we think of as citizens of the United States, our government is out there, and that, you know, that it's acting on behalf of the people of the United States. Well, it is to some degree. Maybe 1% of what they do is for our benefit, but the rest of it is you know, privatized. And particularly since the Reagan era, American foreign policy is out there in support of major individual corporations or industries to make the world safer for those industries. And, of course, the oil industry is one of them. The Saudi Arabians are in the oil business. The Texans are in the oil business. And they make deals. Dick Cheney even went on to say at one point, he says, you know, that we can't really judge our friends or our enemies. He said we just have to go to where the oil is and make whatever deal we have to make. So this is, but we don't necessarily get told about those things or the ramifications of what those deals really are.
And you also have the drug cartels, too, as a part of this process, where the financing that was started in the 1980s really empowered a lot of individuals who were really relatively low-level players. And this really put them into the international scene and gave them a lot of power. And a lot of the money that was flowing in at that point, of course, was from Saudi Arabia and the United States through President Zia in Pakistan. So this relationship that the U.S. has had with Saudi Arabia in financing Islamists is very, very long-lived. This is nothing new. Truthfully, you have to go back to the 19th century where you see the British involved in the same process of trying to actually activate Islamists against any kind of modern progression. This is certainly something that happened to King Amanullah in Afghanistan in the 1920s, who was trying to do things like give women the right to vote and change some of the ancient tribal customs that involved things like bride tax and really bring Afghans into the modern world. Well, it turned out that it really wasn't the Afghan people that didn't want to progress into the modern world. It was actually the British Empire that actually stirred up the sort of the Islamic fervor against Amanullah rather than it being coming from the people. So these are things that, once again, who is really against modernization? Is it really the Afghan people? Was it really the British Empire? In this case, it was the British Empire.
Now, before we run out of time, I have to ask you to respond, and I don't know if you've read it yet or not, but Seymour Hersh in the latest New Yorker has a lengthy piece exploring nuclear weapons in Pakistan. And as far as I'm concerned, I think that's the big ticking elephant in the room. You know, are
it
we?
Certainly is.
This is the thing that scares me the most, because it's almost, there's almost an inevitability to it that at some point a nuclear weapon is going to get in the wrong hands, and whether by accident or design, we're going to see a major, major tragedy in the world.
There's no question about it, and the fact is that it really has not been taken as seriously as it should have been taken in terms of what's been going on ever since the end of the Soviet Union, the fall of the Soviet Union. I remember Liz and I were at a dinner one night many, many, many years ago, probably 1993, and it was in Boston, and there were a number of the university professors that gave advice to the military at the time. And one of these people had just come back from a trip with overseas to that part of the world, to Pakistan and Afghanistan, and on a military tour. So I said, "What is the situation regarding proliferation?" And he said, "Oh, it's very good." I said, "What do you mean very good?" He says, "I don't mean very good in terms of we're getting it under control. I mean it's very good. The proliferation is very good. All those ex-Soviet scientists are all getting bids from all these third world countries in the Middle East and all over the South Central Asia to come and help them refine uranium and develop nuclear weapons." So that was in the early 1990s. Now, the United States, of course, just kind of, you know, in general, the Clinton administration was better at it, but the Bush administration really just kind of turned its back on the whole issue of proliferation. So we've had pretty much a decade at this point of that stuff just getting out and around all over the place. And, of course, what is the center of this? Pakistan is the center of this particular enterprise. And, you know, and once again, what has been done in order to do that? That's what the United States has to face up to right now. And you're right, Coy. I think it, we're definitely facing a situation where something is going to happen, and it's not going to be good. And whatever does happen, I mean, if it's going to happen anywhere in the world, it's going to be centered around Pakistan.
It already almost happened twice, actually, with Pakistan and India. So we're already looking at a very, very delicate situation.
Yeah. I mean, Pakistan and India are much more on the brink than the U.S. and Russia ever were.
Exactly.
Oh, yes.
Exactly.
Completely. I mean, it's literally that you have to realize that it goes back centuries in that part of the world. The ethnic feuding, the grudges, the Mughal Empire, the Punjabis ran the Mughal Empire for the Mughals. And the Mughals and the Pashtuns were at war with each other, you know, for hundreds of years before Afghanistan finally settled itself as a nation. And so what the British Empire did was, of course, they went in and they set the Punjabis up as the military arm of their empire in that part of the world, and that's what we're living with today. So these are ancient feuds.
And that's why it's so important that if President Obama really wants to have a positive effect on our future, he really has to deal with the relationship between Pakistan and India. That is directly related to the most serious concern we all have about an issue with proliferation actually going active.
Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald, acclaimed journalists. Their new book is Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story. Thank you both so much. I always enjoy it.
Well, thank you,
Coy.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.